We have in our studios tonight Mr. Merlin Spencer, who is chief of the Seattle Bureau of Associated Press and is making a trip through the territory of Alaska. What is your trip up here, Mr. Spencer? What's the purpose of it?
Well, the primary purpose of the trip is the fact that news from Alaska has become increasingly important, both because of the fact that Alaska is important in a defense standpoint, and secondly, because of the economic growth of Alaska. Consequently, with more news coming in from Alaska all the time, we thought it was necessary to get somebody up here and look the entire situation over, make arrangements for more complete coverage of Alaska news, same time make arrangements for to send more news to Alaska.
Yes, I was going to mention that works both ways, that through the years, Alaska has been building up a better news coverage. How would you say our news coverage appears up here in comparison to what you get outside, the general information available to the public on what's going on in the world?
Well, several years ago, as I understand it, although I wasn't around this area at that time, the Alaskans, many of whom came from the Northwest country, were interested primarily in what was happening in Seattle and other Northwest points. Now, you have a more cosmopolitan population in Alaska. You have a lot of people who have come from the East, Midwest, and other points. Consequently, a wider variety of news is given to the people here now than ever before. I think that a newspaper or a radio station in Alaska is now giving almost as much news, certainly all of the top news, as much so as you would find in any newspaper or radio station in the United States.
Have you talked to people in Alaska enough informally to gather any comparison between the news consciousness of people here and those in the States? I noticed when I came up here about 4 months ago that there was almost a war hysteria in the States. The people along the Pacific coast seemed to be so conscious that there was a possibility of war, of the international situation becoming acute. Have you noticed any feeling like that up here? Could you draw a comparison?
Yes, I think so. The Alaskans are taking it much more sensibly, you might say, or at least they're not becoming quite so upset about the situation as they do elsewhere. I think probably that might be due to the fact that they might be closer to what we might call the firing line. It was just like it was during the war. You remember during the war in San Francisco and some of the other coastal cities, they had brownouts. Everyone was very conscious of the war, while at the same time I was at a place called Port Moresby, which in New Guinea, which was only about 30 minutes away from the first Japanese airfield. There we left the lights on just as bright as we could and until the very last minute. And I think we were less conscious of the danger of war there, as a matter of fact, than they were back in the United States. And I think the same situation applies here now.
I hadn't exactly thought of it in that light before. I had considered the possibility that, generally speaking, we here in Alaska live a little closer to nature and possibly even have to be a little more self-sufficient than people living in the cities outside, and that might have something to do with it, too.
It might be due to the fact that you have to work a little harder here, and as a result, you have less time to think about these other things.
Well, tell me this. Do you suppose the day will come when the Associated Press will have an operating bureau here?
I don't think there's any question about it. Someday, as long as the territory continues to expand, and particularly if it should get statehood, I don't think there's any question about it, but we'd put one in right away, or just as soon as the time comes when it will serve to the best advantage.
Well, judging by this, I believe it's a $200 million Alaska development program that the government is sponsoring now. If the government is interested enough in Alaska to try to develop the industries and the population up here, we can't help but grow, can we?
No, I don't see how you can.
Tell me, have you ever been in Alaska before?
Only once before, and that was on a very short trip which I visited Anchorage, and that was about 2 or 3 hours. I saw very little of it.
I hope it wasn't raining that day.
No, there was dust, as a matter of fact. But it so happened that even during that short visit, that coming back now, I can see what a tremendous growth has been made in Anchorage as compared to the time that I was here 2 years ago.
You mentioned being in Port Moresby in the Pacific. Were you returning from the Pacific when you came back through here 2 years ago?
No, this was a... one of the airlines was giving a courtesy flight up here, and I had been back in the States from the Pacific for about 3 or 4 months when I took this trip up here with them.
Mm-hmm. Your service in the Pacific, that was as a correspondent?
That's right.
During the war?
Yes.
Were you in uniform at that time? All correspondents were.
All war correspondents wore the same uniform as an Army officer.
And you were attached to a certain group?
Yes, we would be attached to your major headquarters. In this instance, for the first 3 years, I was attached to MacArthur's headquarters, either in Australia or in New Guinea and later in the Philippines.
Did you actually follow... No, you wouldn't follow the island hopping. You'd be in one central location all the time. Did you make trips out into the field?
Oh, yes. We would work generally... would work at headquarters for about 3 months, and then we would go up on landings, that is, on combat operations for 3 months. I made 7 landings in the 3 years that I was in this Southwest Pacific.
How did you get material like that back to the States? Was there much of a delay? Did you get good service on reporting your material?
Depended upon where you were. Sometimes you sent your copy back, or if you were on a landing, for instance, at Cape Gloucester or some out-of-the-way place like that, you would send your copy back and it might never get back. On the other hand, if you were back at headquarters, in which you had radio facilities which went direct to the United States, your copy would get back in a matter of minutes, or a matter of minutes from the time that you wrote it.
Well, in your travels in the Pacific, I imagine you did quite a bit of traveling. Could you give us some of the highlights of the stories you covered or the things you saw during your service?
During the... do you mean during the war or after the war?
Well, while you were in the Pacific, what stood out most in your mind as a reporter in the Pacific?
Well, strangely enough, the only one incident that I remember particularly, or that really stands out insofar as combat was concerned, was one time when we were going in on an operation at Mindoro, which was in the Philippines. It was the last landing before the landing in Luzon. At that time, I was riding on a cruiser, the Nashville, and there were 4 correspondents aboard, and we were all of us asleep underneath a gun turret. It was one of those days that the Chamber of Commerce would like to talk about. The sky was blue, and it was just a perfect day. And all of a sudden, we were awakened by this terrific blast. A kamikaze had come out from behind a cloud. No one saw the plane. Not a shot was fired at it. And all of a sudden, it struck us amidships. And there was this great big blast, and this great big sheet of flame went up from the center of the ship. And for a second, there wasn't a sound. And then the cries of the wounded began to break the stillness. And it's things that you remember at that time that make you wonder how in the world anyone could ever think of starting another war. I remember particularly one man who came out, and he was walking like an ape walks. His arms were held wide at his far from his side of his body. His legs were spread wide. Been burned terribly. Then they brought out another man, and they carried him out in a litter or a wire basket. And he was a huge man. His shoulders filled the basket. And then he put both hands on the side of the deck along his side, and he lifted himself up, and he looked down. And you can see by the expression of his face that he knew that there was no possible chance for him to live because both legs had been blown off. And I remember he called a medic to his side, and he said, "They'll be all alone now." And you knew, of course, that he was asking this medic to write back to his family. That is the one thing I remember most insofar as the combat is concerned.
Now, you also covered the surrender, the Japanese surrender ceremony, didn't you?
That's right. That, for my money, was the most thrilling thing I've ever experienced. I had gone in with the Marines from the Central Pacific side, and we'd made the landing almost exactly the way we had made other landings, except that there were no shots fired. And then this day, it was on a Sunday, about 8 o'clock, they got all of the correspondents together. There must have been some 300 of them. And they staged this show just as exactly as though they would stage a Broadway production. Everybody was given an assigned place. He was told not to move, not to disturb anything. And I remember I was extremely impressed by the fact that when the Japanese first came alongside, they were riding in a gray whaleboat, and the American flag was trailing in the water behind. And then the Japanese came on deck, and they stood up in front of this table with the green cloth on it. And then I obtained then the strongest impression that I received from the surrender ceremony, and that was that here was this group of Japanese standing before this table. They were completely surrounded by the military leaders of all of the Allied powers, the Americans, the British, the Australians, the Russians, the Canadians, and the others. And not one man among the Japanese had a single friend aboard that ship. And the feeling was terribly strong, and it was just like Japan itself, because Japan then had not a single friend among all the nations in the world. And there certainly can be no more terrible thing than being completely friendless. But I do remember, too, that you were impressed all the time that this was history being made. This was something that you knew would go down into the history books. It was something that the children would study for years and years to come. And on that day, I had seen MacArthur a number of times before. But on that day, he was magnificent. His speech was curt and short. He was every bit the general that one would expect him to be as the supreme commander of the Allied powers.
Well, referring back now to the kamikaze attack on the cruiser and then the surrender, when you were in Japan following that in the era of a supposedly building peace, did you ever think of the implications of the individual, the Japanese, whether or not they could be educated? I was always quite struck by the psychological pattern of mind that a kamikaze pilot must have. Certainly, we wouldn't, as a nation, go in for things like that. Did you wonder and did you investigate to see for yourself if the Japanese people as a whole could be educated out of that fanatical, more or less vein in which they fall?
I think they'll always be fanatics, one way or another. I think it would not be a difficult thing to make them really some sort of a democratic country, for this reason. The Japanese is an Oriental, of course, and the one thing that the Oriental is impressed by is force, it's power, it's strength. The Japanese, when we got there, were very much impressed by the power of the United States. After all, they should have been. Their country was virtually destroyed, and they began to think, well, if a democracy can be so strong as to beat an empire and beat them so badly, then we want to be strong, so let's be a democracy. But in this matter of peace, I was among the correspondents in Guam at the time that the atomic bomb was dropped on the city of Hiroshima. And they brought back from that bombing the pilot and the co-pilot and the scientist who went along and the bombardier. And I remember we had the correspondents on Guam, although the plane had taken off from Tinian, which is only 200 miles away, had known nothing at all about the atomic bomb until President Truman announced it on the radio. And then, of course, we immediately began clamoring for the right to obtain the news and to send it out. And so they set up a press conference for us with these pilots, with the airmen and the scientists. And we went down there and from the hill on Singpak in Guam down to the Bomber Command headquarters. And it was a very hot, sultry day, and it was hot and sultry in this room. And for more than an hour, we sat there talking to this pilot, asking questions. And then the correspondents got back into their trucks again, went back up on the hill. And I think everyone, when they sat down to their typewriters, was impressed by one thing. And that was that finally man had learned how to completely destroy himself. And we felt then that all hopes of real peace, at least in the immediate future, had gone. At least gone until such time as man had learned to handle the atomic bomb or to handle atomic energy. That until such time as that came around, that there couldn't possibly be anything but uneasiness in the world.
Well, there certainly is uneasiness today. And I know we all hope that it will come out all right. And I certainly hope that we in Alaska, the people in Alaska, can benefit from your experience now that you're head of the Seattle branch of the Associated Press to see that we get good news coverage up here and can take our part in things. Incidentally, our time is running out, but I have one more question. Have you written a book?
No. As a matter of fact, I'm probably one of the very few war correspondents who hasn't written a book, and the reason is, I suppose, that I'm just too lazy to get around to do it. It's too late now anyway.
Well, I'd like to be able to talk to you for another 15 minutes, but our time is just about up, so thank you very much, Merlin Spencer.
Went fast, huh?